Hey, it's Sigrita Chandrao, and you're listening to the Mindful of Everything podcast, which calls for the radical healing of the self and community that can allow us to outgrow cultures of scarcity and hyper-individualism so that we can move to more caring and regenerative ways of living and working in community. In this month's episode, we're joined by Hajar Yazdiha, an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Southern California and faculty affiliate of the USC Equity Research Institute.
From the power structure from above, they are telling us that we are less than, they are telling us that we are subordinate, but that we find within our shared history, community, we find strength, we find the spirit of our ancestors, and we carry it forward. And I think that's where the real value lies in thinking about identity politics, not as a matter of division, but really as a matter of thinking about the way that we can build bridges between our groups. And so that's one of the most powerful ways of thinking about non-white identity politics. It's always been a means of building alliances and coalitions, of imagining linked fate between groups that are similarly affected by these systems of power.
Hajar researches the politics of inclusion and exclusion, examining the forces that bring us together and keep us apart as we work to forge collective futures. She is the author of the book, The Struggle for the People's King, How Politics Transforms Memory of the Civil Rights Movement, with Princeton University Press. She is also a public scholar whose writing and research has been featured in outlets including The New York Times, Time Magazine, LA Times, ABC News, The Hill, and The Griot. Thank you so much, Hajar, for coming on to the podcast. It's lovely to have you on today.
Oh my God, I'm so excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. I'm super excited about the conversation today. We sort of connected last year and then we kind of tried to work out on when we would get this space to talk together. So I'm very happy that we're here today together to talk about something that is really expansive. And I hope that we can cover as much as we can in this episode and within this space. So thank you again for joining. But before we begin, it would be lovely if we could just do a breathing exercise. We like doing that before every single episode. I think it's a lovely grounding practice. So it'd be amazing if you could join.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, I love that.
So to begin, as we always do, it'd be great if you could find some space to sort of bring that attention back to the body. We're going to just close our eyes. Again, if you're not able to do that, that's okay. But this is all about just bringing that attention to yourself. So first of all, I would love if we could just be a bit more present in the moment. Notice the energy around you right now. Notice the sounds. Notice how you sort of came into this space. Any particular emotions or thoughts or feelings you had before we began the exercise. I think it's great if we appreciate how this space and this moment is holding us as we prioritize ourselves and the needs of our bodies. We're going to take a few deep breaths together, but just remember throughout the practice and even throughout the episode, remember to take those deep breaths. Really allow yourself to relax. And I hope now your attention is slowly coming to your breathing as you're becoming a bit more aware that you are taking those deep breaths. Let's now bring that attention to the head and the neck. So we're just going to take slow head circles, really allowing the neck to sort of release itself from any tension. It's in a sort of locked position as well, any stress. So we're going to go to the left, take a few head circles, about 2 to 3. If you want to do more, then you're welcome to do that. And then we're going to go to the right. So let's take the head circles to the left first. I'm going to take those to the right as well. Now let's move the attention to the spine back. Slowly extend the back. Really allowing the shoulders to push up. And now we're going to take some circles, the shoulders. So starting from pushing to the back. Allow yourself to feel that really deep in the shoulders and in the back. And I'll take the circles to the front. Now let's bring our attention to our arms and our hands. So it doesn't matter what position they are in right now. Really allow them to relax. Release them from that tension. Let's focus on our tummies. Right now they could be in like a stressed, sort of tensed state. Really just allow those stomach muscles to relax. And now let's go down to the legs and the feet. Again, similarly to the arms and the fingers and the hands, allow them to relax. If you need to move your feet a little bit, do any circular motions with them, then you're welcome to do that too. Anything that can help you and your body relax. So now we're going to take 5 deep breaths together. Take a deep breath in and a deep breath out. Take a deep breath in and a deep breath out. Deep breath in and deep breath out. Take a deep breath in and deep breath out. And last one, deep breath in and deep breath out. And in your own time, when you feel that you're ready, gently open your eyes. Thank you so much for joining us with that, Hajar. I hope that was useful.
That was lovely. Yes. I feel so calm now.
Amazing. That's great to hear. Thank you so much. Right. So to begin the episode off, and I love doing this with every single guest that comes into the show, It would be lovely if you could paint a sort of picture on how you journeyed into the equity research space as a sociology professor and how your sort of professional and personal life has really informed your work. It'd be amazing if you could start off like that.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's so much about my journey that's rooted in just my personal experience as the daughter of Iranian political refugees mm-hmm. and growing up in communities where I often felt like an outsider, where, you know, the kids would sort of ask you like, well, why does your name sound like that? Or, you know, they would mm-hmm. talk about your hair being very frizzy and puffy, or even the fact that like yeah. I had more body hair than, you know, my girlfriends that had blonde hair on their arms.
Yeah, same.
So, yeah, right. And so I think it's these sort of basic experiences as a child that give you this sort of acute sense of the way that the world is socially constructed, the way that there's always kind of a hierarchy, there's a relationship between different groups, and that it's not natural, that you may completely find yourself thinking, I am somebody completely opposite from who they think I am. Mm-hmm. But they are imposing these ideas of who I am on me and limiting who I get to be within these spaces. So it was really from those early experiences that I was always interested in these questions of identity and belonging. And when I went to my undergraduate studies at the University of Virginia, I was an English major because for me, I felt like that was a space where I could really think about these questions of identity. And I loved post-colonial literature and I studied African-American mm. literature. And this was really one of the first times that I started making sense of some of the experiences I'd had and realizing I was not alone in them. And in fact, it was not only groups like me. It wasn't only Iranian kids. It wasn't only kids of immigrants. That there was something common and shared about how power works and shapes the way that we move about the world.
Yeah.
And so really it was in understanding that that was my interest, and also that I was raised by parents who were activists in Iran and really brought that radicalism to us in the States. They always had us asking these critical questions. They were always like, well, how do you know that? And always interrogating those deeper questions so that, you know, nothing my sister and I brought to the table could ever be taken as normative or, you know, taken for granted. So I really think it was in combining that personal interest, the personal experience, with wanting to do something concrete, be able to apply it to understand the social world around me, that I said, okay, I think that's what my doctoral studies need to be, is sociology.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for giving us that insight. And I have to say, I'm fascinated by your work, sort of breaking down how these political processes shape our identities, shape our communities, our ways of being within these larger systems. But I particularly like how you sort of weave together the macro and the micro. And I think a lot of us, when you're obviously understanding these systems and you're trying to find yourself in them, it's difficult to see how those levels interact, let alone overlap and coexist, really. Why is it so important that we bridge that divide?
Yeah, I feel so strongly about this. So I'm really glad you drew it out
yeah.
because I think, you know, so many of us go about the world kind of thinking of it as this flat space mm-hmm. where we're all kind of interacting on an even space. And it's true, some people have more resources than others, but it's very hard to conceptualize the way that power is actually structured mm-hmm. and the way that it ends up kind of manifesting in our individual lives. So for me, it's so important to draw out that the macro level is really the space of institutions and structures and the histories that shape them. This is the space where, you know, the government hands down who you get to be, whether it's an immigrant integration policy, whether it's a law around your ability to marry whoever you want to marry.
Mm-hmm.
But then at the meso level, this is really where, for me, it gets more interesting, because this is the level of groups. This is the level of communities and organizations. This is where you find community, you build identities within a group, you decide who you want to be, and you kind of start pushing back against what's coming from above. And then the micro level, the piece where it's in your individual experiences, your individual interactions day to day on the ground, and then also inside your body, the embodiment of these systems. So thinking about the interplay between the three, for me, is such a valuable way to think about how, yes, you know, power is always shaping the way that we find opportunities, the way that we move about the world, and the way we even think about things. But that at an individual level, if we can come to understand how that macro works, then we actually become much better equipped to do that work, to find community at the meso level, to come together and even just for cathartic purposes, find folks who have shared our experiences and who can sit with us, grieve with us, and maybe grow with us. So I think that's really where I see empowerment in a lot of the kind of digging deep into the messiness and ugliness of how power works. And I always say this to my students because I think it's so easy to really get caught up in, God, it's so depressing. You know, inequality is just built in everywhere and social change is so hard to come by. It feels like we take, you know, one step forward and two steps back all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I always tell them, you know, once you can see the way that the system works, you really find that power within you to think, okay, well, then these are the small changes I can make that actually might manifest great consequences. So for me, it's really a project of empowerment and understanding that interrelationship between macro, meso, and micro.
I think it's also empowering to see and understand the systems are socially constructed, as what you said before. Are the implications of these systems, yes, they're at the physical level, the emotional, psychological, and even spiritual level. Of course, you see that in our daily lives. But even on just understanding that these are socially constructed, that we have created them and that these have been sustained and controlled by certain groups of, you know, power and privilege. But I think just understanding that liberates imaginations at a different level. Through your work, how are you sort of encouraging people and raising that awareness of, yeah, these systems and these sort of frameworks that we use are socially constructed. And so we have the power as people to transform them.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, it comes through in my work as a social movement scholar.
Yeah.
And again, you know, this is really because of being raised by activists themselves and always having a bit of idealism sort of baked into my childhood, my whole ethos. But, you know, I do have this whole body of work that really does focus on those systems of power. It thinks about, you know, how the law structures perceptions of threat against Muslim Americans. It thinks about how media plays a role in constructing perceptions of threat about different immigrant groups.
Mm-hmm.
But then on the other hand, I have a lot of work that looks at the movements that are trying to resist these forces. And sometimes these movements aren't, you know, formal organizations that have existed for a long time. Sometimes they're just everyday people who have come together and said, enough is enough. And so they're coming together and sharing those grievances, but then also sharing a vision of change where they say, okay, if we can actually push back collectively, we might have more power than if we're trying to do it individually or trying to limit it to the votes that we make, you know, every 4 years. And I think that's where the power lies for me is in thinking about just how everyday people who have jobs and families and not a lot of time can actually make meaningful change, but that they can't think about it as an individual process. You really have to find your people and you really have to make your way in community to be able to do that work.
Yeah, and I think this really ties in with the work of identity politics, and it's something that you really center in your work, how our identities are shaped by these sociopolitical processes and systems. Particularly, as you mentioned, people of the diaspora, right? When we move to a land that's quite foreign to us, let's say if you don't really have that support system in place, when you do move or your parents didn't have it or your grandparents didn't have it, it can feel very difficult to find that belonging, right? Particularly in a culture that's so different from your homeland. It can feel really disorientating. So if you could talk a bit more about how identity politics can, for BIPOC communities, but also marginalized communities, find belonging and, you know, find their place within these systems, but also within this culture that they've just moved into and are trying to sort of integrate into.
Yeah. So I think identity politics really gets a bad rap. It's, you know, it's often used as a pejorative. It's been so politicized. It's how, it's how, you know, right-wing groups will shut down ideas about DEI being necessary. You know, they'll just be like, this is just part of identity politics. It's just a politics of division. But the truth is that identity politics has always been a means of coming together for groups that are on the margins, who have historically been oppressed.
Absolutely.
Right? And for them to exercise their own power, to find meaning in their identities, to realize that, yes, you know, from the power structure from above, they are telling us that we are less than, they are telling us that we are subordinate. But that we find within our shared history, community, we find strength, we find the spirit of our ancestors, and we carry it forward.
Yeah.
And I think that's where the real value lies in thinking about identity politics, not as a matter of division, but really as a matter of thinking about the way that we can build bridges between our groups. And so that's one of the most powerful ways of thinking about non-white identity politics. It's always been a means of building alliances and coalitions, of imagining linked fate between groups that are similarly affected by these systems of power. And I think, you know, for me, coalition politics is really central to one of my interests because I think about belonging, not just in the kind of classic form of trying to integrate into a dominant group. I think about belonging as these spaces that are beyond the boundaries. They're really about spaces of common humanity, about a kind of global and universal vision of who we could be.
Yeah.
And I think the other misconception really is that identity politics are limited to folks of color. And if you look at, you know, politics, white identity politics are alive and well. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the only difference really is that white identity politics are shaped by a perception of threat. So rather than being an opportunity to bridge and be inclusive and bring people together, they have been a means of enclosing the boundaries, making sure that, you know, white identity is not threatened by outsiders. And so I think that's an important distinction to make because it is very easy, again, to kind of flatten them and act as if they are very similar things. People will say, for example, that the All Lives Matter movement is just the opposite of Black Lives Matter movement.
Mm-hmm.
But they are doing very separate things. And also they're positioned completely differently within a structure of power. So the power analysis is important for thinking about what they're actually trying to challenge and then the way that they might actually be expanding or contracting the boundaries around national identity, collective identity, and our common humanity.
Mm-hmm. So it has a lot to do with intention, right? A lot of these concepts have been used with, you know, so introduced with the intention of bringing people together. But as time has gone on, sort of seeing the political state of certain countries and nations, they've sort of been weaponized. Is that what you're trying to say? To divide?
Precisely. Yes, they've been weaponized. Yes. It's a perfect divide and conquer politics because it sounds like a mode of division. When you hear identity politics, you think it means that all you're doing is drawing these firm circles around who this group is, who that group is, trying to tell them who they get to be. And it's actually the opposite because it's really trying to challenge that idea. And I also just want to point out that, you know, identity politics and some of the core concepts really are rooted in Black feminism and going back to the Combahee collective and thinking about the idea of collective liberation. And that's so foundational because I think folks who do feel threatened by some of these ideas and these movements often perceive that it's coming for them somehow, that somehow it's making whiteness a bad identity. Somehow it's some form of quote unquote reverse racism. And it's the opposite because really what it's trying to do is create a space where we can all be free. You know, as Fannie Lou Hamer said, no one is free until everyone is free.
Yeah.
I think that for me has been such a guiding force because it reminds me that when we fight for other groups, we're not just fighting for them. We're really fighting for ourselves. Everybody wins. So I think that's so important to keep in mind.
Yeah. When we had a conversation before this, you talked about sort of remaking collective memory and finding place in larger memory. And I think this really ties into that. For example, the civil rights movement, you talk about that in your book, The Struggle for the People's King. A lot of people will think, well, the sort of struggles and the resistance and the stories of Black Americans is something that is just limited to that community, right? Oh, I don't have a right to contribute to that movement, or, you know, I can't relate because I'm not from that community. Even Black feminism, a lot of people think is just talking about Black women. Those values and those concepts and those visions cannot extend out and do not overlap with other justice movements and feminist schools of thought. I have seen that when I talk to people, when I talk to friends and family, that sort of resistance sort of comes up because they've created these very strong walls around their community. They feel that, you know, you can't have any overlap or any sort of flowing of ideas. What power can we get from actually situating ourselves in larger memory, in the histories of, you know, communities that we're not part of or we're not directly connected to, but that their liberation is so important for our liberation?
Yeah, no, I completely agree with everything you said. I mean, I think one of the things I really explore in the book is this question of what it means for other people to use a collective memory that belongs to one group.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, in the book, I'm really thinking about how Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s memory gets co-opted by all these different groups across the political spectrum, using it for their political purposes. And I talk about some of the messiness that occurs even when really well-intentioned progressive groups like immigrant rights activists or Muslim rights activists pick up that memory and try to use it to claim their own rights.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the messiness comes in thinking about the difference between co-opting and taking for yourself somebody else's memory or extending it, expanding it. And I think that's really the key, because this is where you see, for example, you run into groups that end up perpetuating the kind of anti-Black narrative because they use the memory of civil rights to claim that they are the new minorities. Mm-hmm. You'll hear, for example, in my study, I do one chapter on the gay rights movement, and they'll say gay is the new Black.
Ooh.
And so just by the language alone, you know, it inherently has this implicit idea that there are no Black people within their movement. And you look at who's leading the movement, it's most often, you know, white Americans. And so it's one of these kind of troubling reckonings within a movement, because over time they come to realize, you know, actually, it's not that gay is the new Black. It's really that we're thinking about the folks that were queer within the civil rights movement itself. We're drawing those histories out that have been buried and sanitized, and then thinking about how those movements for racial justice laid the groundwork for all of these other groups to claim their rights. Same is true for immigrant rights activists, right? They have to really contend with the fact that immigration to the United States post-1965 for non-white groups only took place because of the work that Black civil rights activists did. And so even though their communities most often try to align themselves with white Americans because that's really where their power lies, they have to think about what that means when they are doing the strategic distancing from Black Americans, who they owe so much to. So for me, collective memory in the book ends up becoming this opportunity, because I think when we can see ourselves and part of a larger story about who we are as a people, who we have been, where we've come from together, then it's much easier to build those bridges in the present and realize we are not pitted against one another naturally. In fact, that is a politics that has been created from above to divide and conquer us. And it's much easier to see that our fellow people are not the threats. The real threat is the kind of power that comes from above. So I know this sounds, you know, a little radical, because it really is kind of challenging the idea that the institutions are serving our best interests, or, you know, that we can potentially vote for a party that is going to help us out. For me, it's really about questioning those structures and thinking about who they serve, especially when they do perpetuate the idea that there are groups that are threats to the national identity, groups that are threats to our kind of existence. If you think about like great replacement theory, for example, which talks about white existence being under threat. So I think those are some of the complex ideas that come out in thinking about the role of collective memory and being a place where we can find ourselves, where we can find our community. And then also have a much more expansive sense of where we might go in the future.
Yeah, I guess it's also the difference between appropriation and appreciation, and how we can make sure that we are not corrupting, we're not speaking for, we're standing with. And I think sort of society that we're in and the culture we're in, very capitalist, colonial even society, right? We often just tend to speak over, and we forget about the power of actually standing with and working with. I think if we have that shift in our communities, and we have that shift even within us and how we see, you know, how we understand the world and how we're engaging in this work, I think that's the key. And that's a lot of times what people miss, is that we have to work together. And like you said, it's not natural for us to be pitted against each other. That's very unnatural. If you look out in nature and how the earth works as well, everything has to work together. There is not this sort of fragmentation. And if you have those ruptures, actually, then we are seeing the effects of that, right? We need to work together. There can't be those fragmentations.
Yes, 100%. I mean, I say in the conclusion of the book, you know, if COVID-19 taught us anything, it's, you know, what are we living for if not one another?
Yeah.
And I believe that so deeply, because as humans, we're social beings. And that's one of the easiest things to forget. I feel like one of my personal qualms, especially as a sociologist, is that anytime there's sort of human conflict, war, people will talk about human nature. They'll say, oh, that's just human nature. And I'm constantly saying, no, it's actually not. Mm-hmm. It is not human nature. We are meant to be in community with one another. And it's true that, you know, we have these cognitive processes where we might think small things are bigger threats than they are. We might think, you know, that speaking on a stage inspires in us the same kind of perception of threat as like if a rhino was chasing after us. Mm. It's true that, you know, the quote unquote lizard brain is very real. But it is also to say that we have evolved in such ways that we can honor the fact that we are social beings. We don't have to numb it away and allow these larger structures. And like you said, capitalism is actually a really big part of it. And, you know, it really alienates us, not just from one another, but also from ourselves. So we become so disconnected from our inner sense of conscience, our inner sense of morality. And I mean, it's one of the great issues when you think about like the rise of drug use, the rise of suicide. These are all interconnected with exactly what you're talking about.
Exactly. And somatic work is intimately tied with the liberation of people. If you understand yourself and if you're able to locate yourself within the system of your body and how that system sort of interacts with other systems, other bodies, but then also the system at the macro level. Yeah, that work is really, really crucial to do before that. And that's why even in like, for example, my dissertation and my master's, I really try to bring that emotional into the social and the environmental, because my work is lying in environmental policy. And again, that emotional aspect of policy work or decision making is just completely just not there, right? You strip that off, the emotions and the heart, because like you said, that serves capitalism. You have to be completely robotic, very mechanical and very strategic to actually profit from that system and to thrive in it and to serve it. So if we're able to tap into our bodies, which is exactly why I love to do that practice right at the beginning of the episode, it really makes a difference. And I think in that way, you're resisting the system.
Yes.
Right? Just existing and holding space for your emotions, talking to one another, being transparent, holding each other accountable. All of that work is very, very intimate and it's really, really tied to the body. And I think we often don't value the body and the importance of the body. I think if we are able to value that, then a lot of change can happen just from that act of resistance, right? Valuing and respecting your body.
I couldn't agree more. And I mean, this is something I'm working on too, because the hustle culture is so real. And especially, you know, child of immigrants, like you really feel like you want to do better. Like you really want to prove to your parents that this was all worth it, all of their struggles and sacrifices.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so it does actually become very difficult to center yourself in any kind of meaningful way, or even to tap into what for many of us is a lot of kind of built up trauma. It might be intergenerational trauma. It could just be the trauma of growing up as an outsider and having to kind of hold down and swallow a lot of feelings and experiences. But I think the somatic work is really, it can't be, you know, overstated. Like it's so, so important. And I think especially as sociologists, we so often think about, you know, the networks of humans, like the social beings as connections, organizations. And yet the individual still is so powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the work of, like you said, collective liberation can't even occur until you do that work on yourself. Because what are you bringing to that work if you are an empty shell, if you are not in touch with your body? So, I mean, yeah, I say this. And also, as we were doing the breathing exercises, I was reminded of how bad I am at meditation. I know we're not supposed to say that.
Yeah.
It's a practice. But like, I've never been good at it, which is why it's been hard for me to sustain it as a practice, because truly my mind is not a present mind. It's a mind that's like always and like years into the future. So, yeah, I mean, I think just recognizing that it is important, that it's the easiest thing to put aside as yourself, like it's, especially if you are taking care of other people, you know, I have two kids, become a mother, it becomes even more difficult to say, I need to take care of myself and I need to look inside myself.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I really think that's so powerful.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I always say that community is therapy. For example, if we see the sort of westernized conceptualization of therapy is very individualized. It's a very flat space. They don't even want to think about how your generations that came before you or even exist right now, how they're interconnected, how their stories have shaped your being and your experiences and your ways of processing and coping. And that's why I say that when we work in community, we see how multidimensional our world is, and nothing is that simple. Nothing should be that simplified. I think it's so important that when we are working on ourselves, we also work with those around us who are also on that journey. And also linking back to what we were talking about, collective memory, it is all about shared vulnerabilities, right? As a human being, but also as a living being, we all have certain vulnerabilities that are shared, certain experiences that are shared. Those experiences have been lived by previous generations and we're continuing to live them, and future generations will live them too. And you being a mother as well, you're seeing that with your children, which I think is really beautiful. So I think a lot of this work needs to create space for that healing because it can be so draining emotionally and spiritually, right? When you're trying to work towards changing these systems whilst living within them.
Yeah. I mean, and I think, so just for the listeners, like I never really said the way I'm thinking about collective memory, but you know, collective memory in my conceptualization is this process of storytelling about who we were in the past and, you know, how it shapes who we are now.
Yeah.
And a lot of times the collective memory of a nation is central to its identity, because this is really the memory that tells us who we are in relation to one another. It tells us who the heroes and the villains of the past were. And it legitimizes the system that exists in the present. It says it's this way for a reason, and these are the reasons why. Because if you look at the past, the way it's been sanitized, mm-hmm. distorted, you know, they make sure to write out all of the things that would actually hold the nation to account. But I think, you know, my book really thinks about that macro piece again, about how collective memory does get revised from the top and then the consequences it has. But what you're saying is, you know, really bringing to light that there's also the collective memory of the people from below, from the grassroots. It's the stories of the people that are really where the power lies. And they're the ones that are held in our bodies. They're the ones that are held through our stories, our, you know, collective, you know, coming together, our rituals. And I think that is actually something that I've wanted to explore more in my own life, because I don't have, you know, a strong sense of connection to Iran and to my family over there. I've never been able to go, which is its own heartbreak, you know. But I think there's so much power in knowing not just where we came from, but the way that we are always embedded, like you said, in this ecosystem, mm-hmm. and that the memory is the way that you honor the violence, the heartbreak, but then also all of the power and the resistance, the stories of rising up, you know, from below against all odds, and truly doing remarkable things. And so I think that can carry us so far.
Yeah, this reminds me of what we were talking about in the previous conversation with Katia Lovejoy, who was talking about ancestral memory and ancestral joy and resilience. And she was talking about how memories are not static, they're very dynamic. And it also is about the intention in which we tap into those memories. So she was, of course, talking about that in terms of intergenerational trauma. Oftentimes when we are remembering, right, or we're tapping into that memory, we pull out the pain, right? And that's what restricts us, or that's what limits our growth as we're healing. But then when we feel that we have the capacity to tap into the joyful parts of that memory, that's where the resilience emerges from. And if we are talking about the collective and the larger memory, and we are talking about sort of understanding these histories of, for example, Black Americans and other sort of groups that have been subject to histories of violence and brutality, if we tap into the joyful parts, then that brings so much power that their work is why we're here today. And that in itself is so joyful. And that's how we build resilience. And I love seeing memories like that now. You know, it's kind of like an orb, and you're sort of picking out you want from that. But of course, not trying to change it or to distort it or to tell a different story, which the systems have done for so long. We're holding space actually for the good and for the bad, for the happiness and for the sort of sorrow and the grief. I think it's a big part of, you know, when we're trying to make those bridges.
Yeah.
When we're able to hold space for both of those aspects.
Yeah, I think it's one of the great challenges of being a human is the uncomfortable feelings and the sadness. And we want everything to feel joyful and everything to feel hopeful. But like you said, it's holding them alongside one another, because how do we feel joy if we don't know
exactly.
pain?
Exactly.
So, right. And so I think that's such a lovely, lovely way to think about. I'll have to go listen to that last episode. And you know, one of the things I've been thinking about a lot lately is, you know, I've been bearing witness to the devastation in Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot about how those of us who are being intentional about bearing witness are sharing a memory. We are holding a memory. We are making sure that that memory does not get erased. It does not get put aside. And though the memory is traumatic and truly some of the worst things I've ever seen in my life, I also have to believe that on the other side of that, there is going to be the power of the people, right? The mm-hmm. liberation, it is coming, and something good will come of it, because it has already connected us in a way that we weren't connected before.
Yeah. And I feel that those communities, they know how to create spaces for joy and for hope. right? They're constantly doing that because that's how you survive. And that's how you also break out of survivorship as well. With that hope that, yeah, the reality, this reality that I'm living right now, it can change and it will change. And that's how they create those pockets of hope and joy. When they're experiencing such violence, me right now living here in London and I'm in the safety of my home, I cannot understand because I haven't been through that. But because of my shared vulnerability as a human being, I don't have to go through that to understand that that is wrong and that is a violation of their right to live peacefully and happily. And as a human being, you should already have that understanding.
Yeah. And I think this is, again, where the power of collective memory can come in, because on the one hand, collective memory can do this enclosure. It can be limited. It can bind a memory to say, oh, this memory is only ours and it cannot be applied to any other group. At the same time, that memory can be expansive. It could be used as a pattern of what it looks like when you really do say never again, when you really, you know, understand that you don't want your fellow humans to suffer, and that having an expansive vision of the past is not about giving away your power. Mm-hmm. It's not about even dulling the trauma that you have experienced that was very real, but it is about that idea that trauma can either debilitate you, stick you in the past, and you're immovable, or it can be transformative. And it's the transformative capacities of trauma that have always fascinated me. So, for example, my husband went through an awful trauma where a mentor committed suicide and he was very close to him, and it devastated him in a way that even vicariously, you know, I felt, but it's not the same as having been there, you know, being privy to it. At the same time, I remember like reading about the transformative trauma kind of idea, the model, and just saying to him, this doesn't have to stop your life, right?
Yeah.
You don't have to be frozen in this moment where you're replaying over and over. You can think about what this has opened up for you. Is there some way not to think about a silver lining, because I think that's disingenuous, but to think about what you can do with that grief, with the horror that lives within you? And think about how it may actually be a way to connect with other people, to make sure that others don't actually end up in that same situation, or if they do, that they aren't alone in it. So anyway, that's just all to say that I do think, you know, memory and trauma and all of these things that we often think about as kind of individual processes are really collective.
Yeah. And like you said, it helps you to not feel alone.
Yes.
Because when you are living in such a fragmented world, of course, it's easier to control a world that's so fragmented and so hyper-individualized. Really, really heartwarming to know that there are people out there who are working to bring everyone together. If we're able to sort of overcome that feeling of hopelessness and feeling completely alone, yeah, this work just becomes that bit easier. Because it's natural for us to be in community. Humans are very social beings. We cannot live in an isolated sort of manner. So yeah, thank you so much for actually sharing that story of your husband. Because again, it taps into what we were talking about before, right? Holding that space for the joy and for the pain. He had that pain of losing his mentor, but also being able to recall the sort of happy memories from that, but also what that specific situation and how that's sort of shaped him as a person today and how that continues to shape him and what good he can do for that wider community based on that experience. So thank you so much for sharing that.
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, I also think what you're saying has me thinking about how I'm always telling my students that, you know, we want to think about social movements as making progress and thinking about their successes, but social change is never linear. You know, it's like I said, you know, a lot of times we're going backwards and it feels sometimes like it's cyclical and we're just kind of spinning our wheels. But the same is true of our individual trajectories.
Mm-hmm.
And grief itself is not linear. You never really recover from some of these deep, deep, you know, wounds that occur in our lives. But I think it's almost freeing to understand that, because then we no longer feel like something is broken or something is wrong with us if we are going, you know, on the roller coaster. We're no longer going uphill and towards some upward trajectory. And so once we're freed of that expectation, it's much easier to just be a human and to just exist.
Yeah, absolutely. And what you talked about, storytelling. So I love looking towards my ancestors, my Indian ancestors, but also just the ancestors in nature as well, like the trees and the birds and even the stories of the land, the stories of the people, they have never been linear. And I think that's also a very westernized take on storytelling. Again, what you talked about, like who the hero is in the story and who the villain is, that is also very simplified. And I think a lot of the ancient stories of our people, they have never been linear, right? They've never had that. They've always been very fluid. They've been cyclical. I think they've also held space for sort of appreciating, but also sort of challenging norms and the ways people have done certain things. And in that way, there is no hero and there is no villain, no concrete sort of role of this is a villain and this is a hero. I think that's really beautiful just to see that storytelling is not linear. It has that complexity in it and that dynamism. And that's where I kind of like to look at the ancestors and the stories of the ancestors and the land, because they've never sort of seen storytelling in that way. And that's what we've carried forward as well. The world is so complex. We cannot just simplify for our own benefit.
Yeah. I mean, for my students right now, for many of them, their first election. And, you know, they're facing Biden or Trump and they're disillusioned. They're not really excited about either candidate. And they say to me, you know, what are we supposed to do? Like, we don't want to not vote because people already think like Gen Z doesn't care about anything. They're apathetic. And I say to them that for one thing, yes, of course, vote. You don't have to vote for either of the two parties. It's actually part of the limits of our imagination is that we actually think that this is the only way that we can function. But I also tell them to expand their imagination beyond the idea that their agency is limited to the voting booth.
Exactly.
I think there's so much more that we can do. And I tell them that it's better to just go back to the building blocks of being a human, which means to sit with your creativity, to think, you know, to imagine. And I think imagination is one of the first things to go as you get older. It's limited to childhood, right? It's considered frivolous after a certain point. But I think if we allow ourselves not just to dream, but to envision, I think that's really where some of this, you know, taking some of the past, moving it into the future, thinking beyond the idea of, you know, linear progress, all of these things really come together for me in imagination. So I really always want to drive home, like, that is not, you know, just daydreaming and looking at the sky and twirling your hair. That is actually a liberatory praxis. So let us imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of people believe that they don't have the right to, or they don't have the privilege to, or the power to imagine, when in fact, that's something that we've inherited from our ancestors. But also, we also draw that inspiration from each other, right? To imagine, seeing how other people imagine, and then expanding that, like you said, right? It's all about expansion and extending the work of people that have come before us and the work of people that are here present. It's all of that.
Yeah. So I have to say too, that for those that like want the facts, that thinks this just sounds like very woo-woo, you know, like, oh, yeah, we're just going to sit around and imagine as if we don't have 100 other things to do. There is really interesting research in neuroscience that shows actually that folks that sit and study history have a much more expansive imagination around the future.
Yeah.
So it actually activates neural pathways in the brain that allow you to imagine something much broader, more creative, more innovative about how society might move into the future if you have a better understanding of the past. And so it's just that interconnection, right? Like it's the timescapes where you have the ability to connect what's happened to what might happen. That's a skill, and it's a skill worth building.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's how we're here and we're present. That's how you build resilience. That's how our ancestors done it. So it's all about learning, unlearning and relearning and, you know, sort of mixing that together. Thank you so much, Hajar. I'm just buzzing with energy right now.
I am too.
I love talking about all of this. And thank you so much for sort of dismantling identity politics as well. Yeah, I'm really, really grateful that you could break that down for us.
Yeah, no. Oh my God, thank you. I'm like buzzing as well. And this is just, it's a refreshing space. So I'm very grateful that you've created this space for us.
Thank you for listening to the Mindful of Everything podcast. To stay updated with recent releases for the podcast and to connect with inspiring guests like Hajar, subscribe to the podcast and follow the show on Instagram and Facebook. Don't forget to give a rating on iTunes so that the show can reach other wonderful humans like you who also enjoy engaging in the conversations held in this space. To find out more about Hajar's work and to access her services, as well as accessing full episode resources, visit mindfuloveverything.com. Thank you so much for being a part of the Mindful of Everything community, and I hope to see you here again next month.